Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Good morning, everybody. Hare Krishna. Since I was here last time, I don't know if the article came out before or afterwards, but congratulations to Hare Krishna, one of the 28 most interesting people in Gainesville. Very nice article. I haven't seen. It's posted in Alachua. today we're going to be reading a verse from the 17th chapter of the 11th canto. But just to give a little context to that verse, this section of the Srimad Bhagavatam is a very famous section, actually, the Uddhava Gita, where just before he departs for the spiritual world to return to his own abode, Krishna gives many valuable instructions to Uddhava. And so many different subject matters are covered here. Just like in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Does anybody know what the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita is entitled? Opulences of the Absolute, I believe. Well, in the 16th chapter of the 11th canto, Krishna describes to Uddhava his opulences also. So there's a more detailed description there in the 16th chapter of this 11th canto that we find similar to the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. In the 17th and 18th chapters, there's a description of the Varnashrama system. So four Varnas and four Ashrams. Real quick, what are the Varnas? Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Sudra. Thank you, Damodara. And the ashramas? Yes, Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, and Sannyas. And so each of these ashrams and varnas, they have various duties associated with them. It's quite a detailed description. And so there's a lot of instruction in the 17th and 18th chapters of the 11th canto. And so we're going to be reading in the 17th canto, 17th chapter, text number 53, which is part of the discussions there. And so we will chant the verse. It's on the board up here. Let me do the word meanings. Putra of children, dara, wife, apta, relatives, bandunam, and friends, sagama, the association, living together, panta, of travelers, sagama, association, anudeham, with each change of body, viyanti, they are separated, iti, all these, swapna, a dream, nidra, in sleep, anuga, occurring, yata, just as. Putra dharapta bandhunam. Sagama panta sagama, anudeham viyantyeti, swapno niranugo yata, putra darapta bandunam, sangama panta sangama, anudeham viyantyete, swapno niranugo yata. Please chant.
Anudeham viyantyete.
ladies. Anyone else? I forgot, you have a verse you chant, right? We didn't
no,
do that.
No,
no, okay, great. So then, we're ready for the translation. Translation, the association of children, wife, relatives, and friends is just like the brief meeting of travelers. With each change of body, one is separated from all such associates, just as one loses the objects one possesses in a dream when the dream is over. So we want to read the purport. Why don't we start with Ali Krishna?
Pantha Sangama indicates the momentary association of travelers at hotels, restaurants, tourist spots, or in more traditional culture, freshwater wells and walking paths. We are now associated with many relatives, friends, and well-wishers. But as soon as we change our material body, we will immediately be separated from all these associates. Just upon awakening, we are immediately separated from the imaginary situation of a dream. One becomes attached to the sense gratification of one's dream, and similarly under the spell of the illusionary concepts of I and mine, we become attached to so-called relatives and friends who gratify our sense of false ego. Unfortunately, such fleeting egoistic association covers our real knowledge of the self and the supreme, and we remain hovering in material illusion, fruitfully endeavoring for permanent sense gratification. One who remains attached to the bodily concept of family and friends cannot possibly give up the false egoism of I and mine, or I am everything and everything is mine.
Without giving up material sense gratification, we cannot become steady on the transcendental platform of devotional service, and therefore we cannot relish the actual flavor of eternal happiness. Unless one becomes a pure devotee of the Lord, accepting Lord Krishna as one's only friend, one cannot give up hankering for temporary and superficial material relationships. A traveler far away from his home and loved ones may strike up superficial conversations with other travelers, but such relationships have no ultimate meaning. One should therefore revive one's lost relationship with Krishna. We are constitutionally part and parcel of Lord Krishna, who is the reservoir of all spiritual pleasure, and our original relationship with Him is full of love and happiness.
But because of our desire to enjoy independently from Him, we fall down into the confusing, meaningless network of material relationships created by Maya. An intelligent person realizes there is no actual pleasure or satisfaction for the soul on either this planet or any other material planet. Therefore, like a weary traveler, exhausted from his journey, he should go back home, back to Godhead, for eternal peace, as the faithful servant of Lord Sri Krishna.
Okay. Thank you. So as I mentioned, this section is describing the Varnashram system. And so this verse primarily results refers to which ashram are we referring to here? Grihastha ashram. Is that all you see in there? Is this Grihastha ashram, or do you see anything more? Yeah, I think probably if we look at it closely, we can see all instructions for all of the ashrams there in this. Obviously, yes, the Grihastha ashram, because it's talking about children, wife, and relatives like that. But who in this world doesn't have at least relatives? Even the brahmachari has relatives, the vanaprastha has relatives, sannyas has relatives. And when you really get into a study of the varnashram system, I was listening to a discussion of this yesterday by Gaurav Indamaraj. It was a tape, obviously, as he's left this world many years ago. But he was describing that there are four stages of the grihastha ashram, just as there are four stages of the sannyas ashram. And they all relate to how we interact with our family. And so no matter what ashram you may find yourself in, the questions and the instructions here are going to be valuable. So who remembers something about the purport we just read? I hope you're listening, because there are three main points in the purport. And so what are they? Want to tell us, Ankush, what the...
Our relationship with Krishna is only meaningful as, like, because when we go with travelers and friends, like Prabhupada said, we will have only superficial conversations. So that will not be meaningful relationship, but only our relationship with Krishna is meaningful. So we should pay attention to that.
So he's given us actually two of them. One is the real relationship with Krishna, right? And the other is the illusory relationships we have in this world. Okay, so one more lesson. Who saw? Balaram Singh.
Maharaj says that unless we develop complete detachment from these bodily concepts of life, these material relationships, there's no possibility of us becoming free from the influence of the material energy.
Very good. That's the third one there, that what we're trapped in these illusory relationships because we're attached to them. And therefore, unless we give them up, we're not going to be able to move from those illusory relationships to our real relationships. Okay? Those are three points in the purport. So I think it's good to always to try to understand the lessons that the purport gives us. So these three questions or topics bring us to our topic question for today. And that is, how do we develop our real or enlightened relationships? The Kanta Prabhu has given us this topic of enlightened relationships. So the topic question is, how do we develop those enlightened relationships? And what I'd like to do is go down two tracks for this. Welcome. Is there a seat for him? Okay. There are two tracks I'd like to discuss in terms of enlightened relationships, and they have to do with our existence. Because all of us, we find ourselves in this world, and we have certain relations in this world. But we're also spirit soul, and we know, therefore, that we have a whole other existence in the spiritual world as spirit soul. And so it's possible, and we're going to discuss this today, to have enlightened relationships, or at least we should have enlightened relationships on both sides, both in terms of our existence in this world and our existence in the spiritual world. So let's start with our current relationship. Yes. Yes. Our material relationships and our spiritual relationships. How are both of them going to become enlightened? That's what we want to discuss today. All right. So let's start with our material relationships. Is that okay? So today happens to be Martin Luther King Day. And for those of you that don't know, there's an interesting article that's on ISKCON News. org. And Martin Luther King actually spent about 2 or 3 months in India. He went there in the 1950s. He said that, I go to other countries as a visitor, but I come to India as a pilgrim. So he was, he had some respect for the religiousness of India and the Vedic culture there. And so actually, his whole life's work sort of preached a certain type of transcendental conception about life. And does anybody know what that it was?
He preached like nonviolence, which he actually got from Gandhi. And I know this because my son was actually studying it, and he told his grandmother not to tell me because he just despised, you know, this religion that I'm in. So he was like, don't tell him that, you know, Martin Luther King got his stuff from Gandhi.
That's very relevant to our discussion about family life today. Okay, but so yes, nonviolence. Bob was saying.
The main thing that agrees was equality, that people should see each other as humans first, and not designate that this side is black, this side is white, so these are the
difference. Right. He preached an equality based on transcending bodily differences. Right. On transcending bodily differences. And I think this is the first thing that we need to try to understand if we're going to talk about enlightened relationships. That if we have relationships that are simply based upon the body and circumstances like we find here, meeting in a hotel or something overnight with others, if we base our relationships on that only, these material conceptions, superficial conceptions, there are bound to be differences, aren't there? I mentioned here last week, I believe, that I've traveled in many different places around the world, and in every place they have differences that they fight over. Even if they have the same bodily complexion, they're fighting over religion. They do that in Northern Ireland, at least they used to do it in Northern Ireland. Catholics and Protestants, they're both of the same race, ethnicity, but they're fighting over the religious differences. In India, Hindu-Muslims, same. All around the world, we find people that can't really have enlightened relationships as long as they're stuck in this material conception about life. And so, first thing is we have to transcend the bodily relations. That's not always an easy thing to do. And so what tool is given to us, what tool that's covered in this particular section of Srimad Bhagavatam is given to us to help us overcome this superficial bodily type of relationships? Nima? Varnashram, of course. Yes, that's what this instruction's about here. It's about Varnashram and how you can overcome the bodily differences, yet work in a united way. One of the primary differences we find in this world is between men and women. And so for the brahmachari, what helps them, what conception that's taught in Varnashram helps the brahmachari transcend the duality of men and women? Anybody can say? Yes, Mother Jita, see every woman as your mother. I mean, this changes the world completely. If you see everyone except your wife, obviously you can't see your wife as your mother. But we'll get to that relationship in a minute. But yes, the brahmacharis taught that to see every woman as mother. And that changes the complete conception of interaction with women, because what's the basis otherwise? What's the basis otherwise if the brahmacharis taught something different? What basis do they have, relationship do they have with the opposite sex? Avoiding is one, yes, but that's the flip side of what? Sexual attraction, right. Sexual attraction and exploitation, right? Prabhupada uses this term, woman hunter. It's a very interesting term because it sort of very graphically explains or introduces this idea that the conception is an exploitation of one another in terms of especially man-woman relationships. And so that's something that the entire system is meant to help us with. Brahmacharis are taught certain relationships, and then in Grihastha Ashram there are other relationships, Vanaprastha, Sannyas, all of these dealing with the duality of man and woman. And so to have an enlightened relationship, we need this training. So let's move to the Grihastha Ashram. Grihastha Ashram is interesting because it's more than just getting married. It's more than just getting married. We think in this set of, so without outside the Varnashram culture, we tend to think, well, yes, I'm going to get married. And that marriage has a certain purpose. Some are very good, obviously, but my point here to you today is that they may not be complete, or they may not be part of this Varnashram approach, because marriage in Varnashram has at its very root the idea of what? What idea is at the very root of marriage in the Varnashram system? Detachment is there, yes. Procreate Krishna conscious children, yes, it's there. Free from material existence. How? How are we going to become? Serving is, we're getting there, but using attachment, making your home a temple, getting there. It's dharma, huh? Isn't it? It's dharma. The performance of religion, the marriage in the Vedic, in the Varnashram system, is meant for coming together to perform one's dharma or one's religious duty in life. Actually, you'll find this conception a lot of times, even in our devotees, a lot of devotees from India, they will get married not because, you know, I gotta get married, you know, because I'm overcome by some kind of lusty feelings or something like that, or no, they get married to sort of fulfill the family obligation. The family's expecting that, oh, my son, my daughter, they'll be married. And so it's a lot of times not even for them, but they're marrying for their family, to fulfill the expectations of their family. And the expectations of dharma or religious duties require a married partner. When Lord Ramachandra, who appeared as the ideal human being, Maryada Purushottam, he showed the example that he could not perform his dharma once Sita was banished, and therefore what did he do? There was a big dilemma. He had to perform a yajna in his kingdom. But Sita was banished from the kingdom, and he had no wife. So what did he do instead? He had a golden murti of Sita made so that he could perform his dharma. He could perform his dharma. So marriage in the Varnashram system is very much dependent upon this concept of dharma, and therefore the wife is sometimes called dharma patni, one's partner in executing devotional relationship. And this kind of conception really kind of elevates us out of just a bodily relationship. I'm getting married because I want to have a relationship with the opposite sex. That's a basis of marriage outside the Varnashram system. But inside the Varnashram system, that is not the motivating factor for marriage. Yes, marriage in the Varnashram system is mainly about performing dharma. Yes. Somebody got some saffron cloth? We just why? That's a very good question, Ankus. We perform dharma in all ashrams. Why is marriage necessary? Well, I think that if Jai Dwaita Swami would give this class, he would say it's not. So, but for the rest of us. Yeah, very good, very good. Yes, that's the Prajapatis. This was the argument that Brahma gave to the four Kumaras, right? His sons, the four Kumaras. At the beginning of the universe, he had four sons, the Kumaras. And he said, you have a duty to our family to procreate and populate the universe. What did the four Kumaras say, though? They said, no, we're not going to do that. Kalakandabhu.
This question was raised to Srila Prabhupada. If everybody joined your movement, then how would the population continue? And Prabhupada said, do you really think there is any danger of that happening?
Right, there's not much danger of that happening. But yes, Matt, but because we are prone to having this material relationship that's not an enlightened relationship. Again, the question here is enlightened relationships. And we're contrasting that with relationships that aren't enlightened. And so it means that we may have the same pushings to make us get married that those outside of our ashram system have, but we want to do it in an enlightened way. Therefore, we do it in terms of religion as opposed to just rejecting it altogether. Okay? Yes? Okay, good question. Is everyone's dharma different, or do we have individual? I think that there's both, obviously. Each of us have dharma according to our own situation in life, our own inclinations, our own abilities. And ultimately, we're meant to use all of our proclivities for service of Krishna, whether that be marred by or marked by, let's say, marked by getting married, whether it's marked by remaining a renunciate throughout our life. We still have to perform our duty. And how does the sannyasi, who's renounced all kinds of social obligations, perform his duty? How does he perform his duty? Yes, by serving Krishna, by dedicating his life in that way. The scriptures tell us that if you dedicate your life to Krishna in that way, then all other obligations that you have will be taken care of. And so, yes, it's individually experienced and we're individually responsible, but there are these four broad categories of brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas that life is broken down into. And as I said earlier, there are different stages we find in all those things. So, how I'm executing my duties as a grihastha may be different than how someone else is executing their duties as a grihastha based on our individual abilities and circumstances in life. Or our varnas, in other words. We have ashram, we have varnas. Brahman's dharma is going to be different than a kshatriya's dharma and so forth like that. Okay? Is that all right? Okay, so that's a look at marriage. But there's another aspect on our material relationship side that's, I think, very important. And that is that these kind of relationships, which are described here, children, wife, relatives, friends, it basically is including the whole gamut of human interaction. And there's a purpose to human interaction, both materially and spiritually. Materially, the purpose of human interaction, we often find to be sort of an exploitative one that sort of, in my mind, is encapsulated in a statement that somebody was talking about China, and they said that they were very excited about China because they were a capitalist, and they said that there are something like 4 billion consumer units in China, or something like that. So they've reduced the human being to a consumer unit because they're interested in selling them something or exploiting them in some way. So they become consumer units rather than people. I think that that's not a very enlightened way of looking at people, because it certainly can lead to exploitation, abuse, and so many other things. So how then should we look at people in terms of our material relationships with them? One thing that I'd like to suggest to you is that, particularly among devotees, that we see our relationships among devotees as being very, very special opportunities for gaining experience in how to love Krishna. For gaining experience in how to love Krishna. My brother-in-law, Varuna, maybe some of you know them, he was one time, when he was a brahmachari, he was driving around America, one of the sannyasis from the Gaudiya Math. It was early. I think it's Mangalmar, the one that was going to come to be. Prabhupada was communicating with him by mail and from 26 Second Avenue in New York in the beginning. He couldn't come, but he came later, and his name was Mangal Maharaj. Mangalinoid Brahmachari at that time, Mangal Maharaj, one of the Gaudiya Math Sannyasis. And so he came and he was driving him around different places. And so the Maharaj, when they were in the solitude of the car driving from one temple to another, asked him about his family. You know, how's your family, this and that. And then he, you know, Varuna, typical Brahmachari, I don't have anything to do with them, you know, they're in Maya, you know. But the sannyasi, you know, chastised him. No, you know, what you should take, you know, responsibility and have your connection with them. He was preaching very strongly about maintaining a family relationship. And he made a point to him that I want to repeat to you here today. He made the point that how will you know about how to interact with Krishna if you don't practice in relationships in this world? Relationships in this world actually give us an opportunity, especially relationships with devotees, give us an opportunity to understand and experience the type of loving relationships that go on in the spiritual world. And so relationships with devotees are very, very important. You know, we often hear different instruction about how to be careful about making offenses to devotees and how we should interact with devotees. But these things are more than just mere etiquette. They're actually enabling us to practice loving relationships so that when we get back to Godhead, we will know what to do. We won't be social misfits in the spiritual world, if there was such a thing. And so I think it behooves all of us to look very carefully at our relationships so that that we learn the lessons that Krishna is trying to teach us by bringing us in contact with different devotees. I had to learn a lesson like this when I joined the library party the first time. Our practice was we'd come together on the weekends and we'd sort of reshuffle and we'd change teams each week. There were certain van leaders and some of us would be assigned, you know, various leaders each week. So the first assignment I got was my godbrother Mahajyoti Prabhu. Right. Exactly, Mr. Congeniality. No one else wanted to go out with him, so they stuck me with him. I was a new guy. And I found that I had to learn some tolerance and humility in his association, which was good for me. I don't begrudge that one bit. But I guess I learned the lesson well because I was with him every week. Every week they kept putting me with him. But I think it's a valuable lesson. And whatever association we get, sometimes we get association of devotees, say like Radhanath Swami or something like that. And he's very generous and loving to us. But if we're not careful, we can take advantage of that or try to exploit it in different ways. And that's also not going to be good for us. So we have to try to learn the lesson that is being taught to us. And this will help us develop enlightened relationships. If we're going to have enlightened relationships and go to the spiritual world, it starts right here by developing enlightened relationships on this. So these are the material side of things. Anybody have any questions about the material side of things? Yes.
I didn't really understood the term enlightened relationship. Are there like some specific points which sort of describe enlightened relationships? Some key points?
I think Krishna consciousness, being Krishna conscious in the relationships we're talking about, having a married relationship based on dharma and the performance of religious duties together, having that as being the predominant thing in our mind about relationships, serving the devotees, having that willingness in our relationship with them, like that, and seeing people as spirit soul, as opposed to just seeing them in terms of their body only. I think if we keep those points in mind, let's just take those three. Seeing things as people as spirit soul, in our marriage relationship or our relationship with the opposite sex, seeing our wife as our Dharma Patni or other women as our mother, and then in serving the Vaishnavas, the associates we have around us. Those are characteristics of enlightened relationships. Okay. Anything else we have? Yes, Ankur?
Sometimes we think, obviously we joke and we have fun, and so it's sometimes we become center of like that
I want to have fun, so like I just talk in whatever, like not whatever way, but it's like I somehow feel like subconsciously we are becoming again the center of the, like whatever the conversation, we're trying to make that. So how do we maintain that consciousness, that to like, and like usually we, like when we talk, so when we're just talking, it might become, sometime when we're joking, it might become prajalpa, like it's not Krishna consciousness. We just, even when we are making like some jokes related to Krishna consciousness, but still there's prajalpa, that's not Krishna conscious. So how do we convert that?
Okay, good question, because we don't want to become, we don't want to lose our personality and lose our life just by being constricted by a bunch of rules and regulations, or well, I have to act like this and everything. We're naturally, we're persons and we want to interact. But we want to try to keep Krishna in the center at the same time. And so therefore, we interact in ways in which allow for that and our personality. And that's going to be so individual and so much a sort of a spontaneous kind of thing that it's hard to really, you know, give specific, you know, answers and things like that. But I think if we have that as a desire in our heart to be, if we see it like that, oh, here's a desire in my heart either to escape Krishna for a few minutes or to include Krishna for a few minutes. Actually, I mean, Krishna is he's the most humorous kind of joking person that you ever would meet, you know. And so when he gets in his association with his friends, they have so many, you know, joking things that are just like completely funny. And so I think that we can look forward to that. And again, I don't know, just not feel constricted. You know, I think if we feel like we are over constricted by rules and regulations, and the spontaneity for loving Krishna and in our relationships won't be there. So it's something you have to watch. It's a good question, and I think keep that question on your mind as you're going through your life's experiences, and Krishna will guide you. Okay. Yes, Anir.
Sometimes I hear devotees say things like, well, my spiritual life is together, but now I need to take care of like my material life and get my material life together. And I feel like there's some danger in that dualism, and same thing seen some of our relationships as spiritual and some of our relationships as material. I think there's a real danger there, because if material indicates that you don't connect that person or that object or with Krishna, then that's then it's material. But any interaction throughout the day, traveling, that can be a spiritual interaction. So I was just wondering if you have any thoughts about the.
That's what is an enlightened person. Enlightened person, you're describing an enlightened person that sees all of their whole existence in terms of Krishna. And that's what we want. We want to come to that level, and we want to eliminate this duality of seeing some things as material and some things as spiritual. And so how to come to that? Well, we practice that. We have the Varnashram system to help us that. We discuss among ourselves. And we try to always remain on that platform, you know, not letting ourselves descend to become degraded in our thoughts and in our actions. And so, yeah, that's the goal to come to, and we want to be an enlightened person. So how to do that? You're going to tell us, Nima? I'm sure you can. I'm sure you can tell us.
So, what would be the relationship between sadhana bhakti and a varnashram system? And while we are in the stage of sadhana bhakti, so is it still possible to have enlightened relationships? Like, or is it when we cross that stage?
The process of sadhana bhakti is meant for developing enlightened relationships in terms of what we're speaking here. Therefore, we have different duties and rules and regulations we follow in sadhana bhakti. And they're meant to promote this development of our consciousness so that we see all these things. And the things we're talking about, seeing all living beings as spirit souls, seeing all circumstances as opportunities for being Krishna conscious. This is what a sadhana bhakta does with his life. And in a sense, you might think it's sort of artificial, but it's not. It's real, but we're relearning it, just like walking. Walking is not artificial, but we have to learn how to do it. And so these enlightened relationships, as Hare Krishna is saying, are real. That's our life. We're meant to be enlightened persons. But how do we get there? We have to practice. And so therefore we have the rules and regulations of sadhana bhakti to help us, to guide us to come to that that stage. And to keep us, when we're not on that stage, Varnashram Prabhupada called it like a safety net. It keeps us from falling all the way back down into material conceptions of life, Varnashram. So we practice Varnashram in that regard. So therefore, in one sense, no, we're not brahmacharis, grihasthas, vanaprasthas, and sannyas. But we utilize those things to regulate our life so that we can advance in Krishna consciousness. I want to cover here the other side of the thing real quickly, because I think we can learn some things on that side too about enlightened relationships in terms of our eternal relationships in the spiritual world. One thing is that Srila Prabhupada was often asked about our relations in the spiritual world, what it'll be like in the spiritual world. And he said something interesting here that's mentioned in the purport to one of these verses to Bhakti Narada Bhakti Sutra. It says here that sometimes when Prabhupada was pressed with inquiries about the spiritual world, he would reply, "You will know when you go there. You'll know when you go there." So, what our relationships will be like in the spiritual world, we'll know when we get there. But there are some hints that are given to us in the Srimad Bhagavatam and other places about what our relationships will be like in the spiritual world. One example we find from Srimad Bhagavatam is that of Dhruva Maharaj. And Dhruva Maharaj is interesting because he had a relationship in this material world that was very important to him in terms of his spiritual life. Does anybody remember what it was? His mother, yes. His mother is the one that told him to go to the forest, you'll find Vishnu there. So when Dhruva Maharaj was going back to Godhead, what relationship did he have with his mother? Guru and disciple. Yeah, he wouldn't go without her. When he was in this, the Vishnu duties had already come, right? And they put him in the plane. That means he's already giving up his body that was related to his mother. He's giving up that body that was related to his mother. He's in the plane. He's going back to God. But then he thought, what about my mother? She's the one that put me on this path. So then what did he see? Yeah, he saw that there she was. She was on another airplane. He recognized her, obviously, right? You know, I don't know what it's like, you know, to be on a flower plane going back to God. I don't know if we're in this body. When we get there, we change bodies. I don't know. But somehow or another, he recognized his mother going back to Godhead. So that means that you'll know when you get there. Our relationships that we have here that put us on the path, that help us along the path of Krishna consciousness, we don't want to give those things up. Why should we? We want those relationships. But what will they be like in the spiritual world? Well, we'll know when we get there, Prabhupada said. We'll know when we get there. But I think that we can take from this lesson of Dhruva Maharaj that there is some relationship and that we will recognize each other. Now, Srila Prabhupada made another statement in this regard. He said that we shall have our ISKCON in the spiritual world. So what does that mean? We shall have our ISKCON in the spiritual world. It means that all of us that are meeting here together, serving here together, that we should all know each other there also, right? We should know each other there also. So that should be encouraging. I don't know. Although I did read a comment on the internet. Someone said that, well, if there's an ISKCON in the spiritual world, then I'm not going to go there. But I think that's unfortunate for that person to have taken that kind of position. But there's some indication that when we get to the spiritual world, we will know each other. And it's not that far-fetched, actually. I mean, we're all here serving together. Or let's take a more mundane example. You're going to school over here, and there's different classmates and things you know. At some later point in your career, maybe 10, 15, 20, 50 years from now, when you meet that person, you'll recognize, oh, we were together in school. So we're serving here together in Prabhupada's movement, and when we get to the spiritual world, we'll also have some remembrance of those that we served with here. Yes?
Another indication in the prayers of Prahlad Maharaj, when he expresses his gratitude to his guru by saying that, how can I ever forget serving my guru even though I get liberated? So that also shows that his relation, he's also aspiring to have a relation with his guru even after.
Of course, the relationship with the guru, we all know that that's a relationship that's eternal. We have it here, we'll have it in the spiritual world, but it's going to be in a different form, isn't it? It's going to be, just like the Goswamis. The Goswamis were here serving Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but in their eternal spiritual relationship, they're manjaris. We know that from the scriptures. And manjaris, they're like intimate associates of Krishna's most intimate gopi associates. And so we have a relationship with Rupa Goswami here in terms of Six Goswami of Vrindavan, following his teachings. When we get to the spiritual world, we'll have a similar relationship with him, following his teachings. Krishna Kripa, you wanted to say something?
That one time Prabhupada said that in the life we attain perfection, we'll remember the details of that life. We'll remember all the people that we knew. And he used as evidence for that the story of Narada Muni, how he related all the details of his life to Vyasadeva. So, yeah.
Scriptural evidence. Very good. So when we get to the spiritual world, our relationships there will be something not foreign to us. The idea of relationships and remembering people and events and places, it's not going to be something foreign to us just because we're in the spiritual sky. So I think that's encouraging. There's a verse in the Upadeshamrita here that I'll read to you that talks about what our relationship will be like in the spiritual world. It's text number 8. The essence of all advice is that one should utilize one's full time, 24 hours a day, in nicely chanting and remembering the Lord's divine name, transcendental form, qualities, and eternal pastimes, thereby gradually engaging one's tongue and mind. In this way, one should reside in Vraja, Goloka Vrindavan, and serve Krishna under the guidance of devotees. One should follow in the footsteps of the Lord's beloved devotees who are deeply attached to his devotional service. So, when we get to the spiritual world, it's all about relationships, all about enlightened relationships. And that those enlightened relationships lead us to this position where we serve Krishna following in the mood of one of the residents of Vrindavan. And so relationships are extremely important, enlightened relationships even more so. And so we need to strive for that and start right now trying to develop these kind of relationships as opposed to material relationships. Sagar?
Can you talk more about the spiritual relationship we have with our spiritual master? It's like sometimes, at least, like sometimes we have a notion like, oh, there will be this person who will be. It's sometimes it's more of a like a spiritual guide thing instead of a spiritual master. Like, oh, he'll, you know, guide. He's a guide, but there's a difference between a guide and a master. So, can you explain that relationship? Like,
I don't know if I can explain it completely right here now, but there are some things that came to my mind when you were asking the question. One thing is there are different stages in our relationship with our guru. And it's described, maybe Krishna Kripa can give us the scriptural quote, but it's described that we have a relationship with our guru that's initially it may be a little formal. It may initially be a little formal. Actually, the second stage, we get first and second initiation. First stage is Harinam initiation. Second stage is Upanaya. Does anybody know what Upanaya means? Yes. It means coming closer. So second initiation means coming closer for more intimate instruction from the guru, right? And so we have an initial relationship with the guru that may be formal. Second initiation, we come closer. And there's also a description that at some stage we develop a very friendly relationship with our guru. We develop a very friendly relationship. So our relationship with our guru goes through different stages, and it's manifest both in this material world as well as in the spiritual world. Where we are very intimately connected with him and engaged in his service. He engages us in the service of Krishna. He introduces us to Krishna. And so that relationship becomes deeper and deeper and deeper as we deserve, as we surrender, as we reciprocate with the guru like that. So that's something generally about it. Yes, Lord.
I'm wondering, I guess, if I had more clarification where those verses come in that describe like the eternal relationship with the spiritual master. Because if we take our lessons from the 11th canto, we learn that there's 24 gurus. And I feel like if we're training ourselves to call everyone Prabhu, then it's like essentially we're seeing everyone as a teacher in some capacity, as a guru. And so I'm just wondering which guru is, you know, do you have that eternal relationship with? And or is it in fact that it's you have that relationship with, you know what I mean? And then I have a, you had mentioned, let's take a more mundane example, and you said like our relationships on campus, and I feel like it's really I feel like that's again dangerous for our Krishna consciousness to see some relationship just because our relationship is with somebody who's not practicing devotional service or maybe even in a lesser degree that's a mundane relationship. And I guess does a mundane relationship, does it have to be two-sided, or, you know, can a spiritual relationship be one-sided, sort of thing?
That's good. Yeah, I wasn't trying to denigrate those relationships. I was just giving an example in another sphere, I should have said. But again, by pointing that out, I think it's very good because it shows how ingrained this kind of thinking is in our mind, this dualistic kind of thinking, that there's material and spiritual kind of things, and we need to come to that enlightened platform. So that's good. But in terms of which guru among the 24 gurus, I think that if we look at the lesson of Bilva Mangal Thakur, he had a whole circumstance where he was caught up in a situation where his guru appeared to him through the voice of a prostitute, actually. And many things happened to him on his journey to Vrindavan that he also took as manifestations of instruction from his guru. And so I think we experience it like that, where we're getting our inspiration, where we're getting our instructions, what our who we spontaneously connect that with. You know, it's going to be revealed to us in that way. So it's obviously we have our guru here, our initiating guru, our instructing spiritual master, and so we have relationships here already. And if we strive to develop them, there's no loss in them, or it's not like, oh, I was striving to develop this relationship, eternal relationship, my guru, but it turned out to be somebody else, and it's not like that. You know, it's not like that. You know, these relationships depend on us, how we cultivate them. It's not just waiting out there to happen. But we have a lot of control of it ourselves, and we should throw ourselves into opportunities given to us by Krishna. Ultimately, who's the guru of everyone? Krishna is the guru. But he manifests in a personal way to us in different forms and different devotees. And so we need to open ourselves to that. You know.
In developing relationships, so sometimes we may have anarthas because of which our relationships may have some troubles. So Krishna says that when one surrenders, then he relieves us of all the anarthas. So is it possible to develop relationships while we are on that stage when we have anarthas within us?
Yeah, certainly it's possible to develop relationships. And they may not be fully developed or the best type of spiritual relationships, but we have to work through the process of sadhana, bhakti, to purify our relationships and everything.